As close to God as he gets, my next guest is a man who doesn't mince his words, and he has a lot of words. He's certainly inspired imaginations the world over with them too, but most of all he has music, and he's found a way of sharing that passion with the rest of us in countless ways. Music as a language, as a way of thinking, as a way of sensing and being in the world. Richard Gill is certainly one of Australia's most acclaimed and admired conductors and music directors and music educators. He's got a lot to say about the future of education in this country. After 50 years of working in music and music education, he's the founding music director of the Victorian Opera, currently overseeing the Sydney Symphony's education program, amongst too many roles to actually name before this interview. He's headed some of our most successful musical institutions, but by his own admission, his is a career marked by devastating failures and uplifting success, all of which he explains in Give Me Excess of It, his new memoir. Welcome to Life Matters, Richard.
Natasha, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Ripper to have you. Can you remember when you first heard Bach? Really heard him?
Yeah, really heard Bach. That was great that you played the C major cello suite, one of my favourite pieces in the whole world. I remember hearing Bach, learning Bach as a student when I was learning piano and not getting it, not understanding it. And then I went to the con, and there was this fantastic harmony teacher called Raymond Hansen. Mm. And Ray said, Bach is what it's about. If you can get on to Bach. But he didn't ever explain it in the sense of saying, I'll show you how to do it. He just said, just wait. And I'd left.
Getting onto Bach ever since.
Well, correct. Well, I'd left the con, and in those days, there was a record society where you could buy long playing records. And I bought a recording of the musical offering. And I remember coming home from school where I'd been teaching all day and putting this recording on. And I have no idea why, but that was the piece that turned me on to Bach, where I thought, I actually understand this. I know what is going on. And then I revisited the entire Preludes and Fugues and the Inventions, the Sinfonias, the Passion, all that sort of stuff. It all made sense. It suddenly clicked. It was a fantastic moment.
You were a late starter amongst your musician peers, weren't you? The mature age of, was it 13?
13 when I started, yeah, which is very late for music, and particularly the sort of music I wanted to do. And as you know, I talk about in the book catching up, and you never do, you know, you really don't. The truth is you don't ever catch up. You spend all your time learning and learning and learning and learning and trying to catch up. But that in itself is also really thrilling, knowing that
we're
always behind.
If you don't start from within the womb, folks,
that's
you're doomed.
Right.
But of course, you don't think that.
I don't think you're very hopeful
about musical education and its potential.
We have to be hopeful, because hope is all we really have. And I don't think it's ever too late. And the thing about music education is its purpose is not to turn every child into a Billy Joel or a Mozart or a Dave Brubeck or whatever it might be. Britney Spears. That's not the aim. The aim is to allow children to make their own music. That's why we teach music. So children can make their own music. You walk into a preschool, you'll see paintings. The kids will have been painting. And then you go into a kindergarten class, they'll be writing little stories. We went shopping. It makes great sense then that they should make up their own music in the same way, with very, very simple ideas. And singing and moving to music and playing classroom instruments are the way that should happen.
Well, it's interesting to me that for a man who has kind of defined and redefined the Australian musical landscape, you actually grew up with a father who was deaf.
Yeah, my father was what they call profoundly deaf. He heard high tones, which was really interesting. But when hearing aids became popular, he tried a hearing aid, but he couldn't stand it. So he used to turn it off because he was so used to a silent world. And there was something in that. There clearly was something in that for him. And the interesting thing about that is he was a great reader. And he always said, if you are reading a book, you are never lonely.
So true.
And he was dead right. And we had what I thought was a big library. We had a bookcase and it was full of books. And for me, that was a great gift. And as children, although we were not wealthy in the, you know, in the sense of we had everything, we had books and we had a big backyard and a big front yard. And they were the days when during the holidays, we were sent to the bush, go out and go into the bush for a day. And it was fine then. You could do that.
You had the radio, though.
Well, the radio was
amazing.
And
you had church.
Yeah.
This is where you encountered music, true and proper.
No question about that. And that's I acknowledge that debt to the nuns, although there were good and bad things about my Catholic education. Let's make no bones about that.
I think in the book, your memoir, it's pretty much mostly bad,
yeah, correct,
actually.
Because it was
you
violent.
You have horrific, horrific memories.
Yeah.
And say you developed a very powerful neurosis about the way one learns and that it took you years to find your feet intellectually about that experience. What was that experience?
Well, there was a lot of caning. And I started school at 4 years and 4 months or whatever it was. And I was what they call a rising five in educational terms because my birthday's in November. Mm. So they would have had to wait a year before I went to school. So they decided to send me to school. And
and you were a failure at five.
Oh, yeah, complete, because I was in the H row, which was hopeless. So there was VG, G and H, and I was in the H block. But the thing is, the interesting thing about it, Natasha, is it didn't worry me then. You know what I mean? Because I didn't really understand it. Mm. It's not too late to think, wow, I was classified as hopeless at 4 years, 5 months, whatever it was. So anyway, the good part of it was the Mass, which was in Latin, which was mysterious, and the fact that before Vatican II, the altar was a secret. And so, you know, when the priest turned around to open the tabernacle and get the host out and the chalice and the elevation and all that sort of stuff.
The theatre.
Yeah, it was fabulous. And there was a choir, you know, in the gallery upstairs, pumping it out, generally nuns, singing plain chant. So that was an extraordinary thing. And I remember that clearly. And I loved singing those hymns. And they were probably tacky hymns. You know, people say they were hymns they came from a book called the St. Basil Hymnal. And a friend of mine said, it's disgusting music, it's vile music, you don't want to sing this rubbish. But I loved it because it was very accessible.
Actually, singing is something you feel very strongly about for children.
Every child should sing.
And
every child should
because
sing.
Because it stayed with you as an influence right throughout your career,
yeah.
Your early love of singing as a kid, hasn't it? Why?
Singing is like exercise. You know how if you walk or you go to the gym or you ride a bike or you do feel better, there is no question about that. We know, you know, exercise is hugely beneficial. That's not a new discovery, right? Singing does that. When kids sing and they feel this buzz, they'll ask to sing more. And I know I've worked with teenagers and you think, well, what teenager is going to get off on singing? They love singing. They love to sing. There's a fantastic example in Melbourne of a school, Melbourne High, which is an all-boys school from year 9 to 12. Every boy in that school sings. Every boy. And I've been to several school assemblies. I'm their music patron. And I have the joy of sitting on that stage and listening to these kids sing. And it is fantastic.
I mean, so often you'll hear people go, well, I can't sing. I can't sing.
If you can speak, you can sing. That means if you can go, mmm.
I think people will still be going, now, Richard, I can't sing.
I know.
I adore singing, I don't get to do it enough anymore.
No. Well, when I come back to Sydney, I'm going to start a series of senior choirs and developing seniors and pre-seniors because there's lots of things for kids' choirs, but suddenly they cut out. So these kids all grow up and have kids of their own, and they still need to continue to sing. So there's a real avenue, I think, there for adult choirs just for singing, for the sake of singing, not necessarily for performing, but like an exercise, sing for your life, if you like. So, and there's no question that everybody can make some sort of sound. And we're not, and that's why when you see people jogging, you're not necessarily looking at Olympic athletes, but they're jogging. They're exercising. You see people riding bikes. They're not Cadel Evans, but they're riding a bike. So
yes, it's all about mastery with music often, isn't it? Rather than just enjoying the amateur experience of playing.
Correct. And it used to be amateur. It used to be all amateur. And there was even a movement at one stage in Europe when they thought if we turn music professional, it will have a bad effect on music. Because it was all about amateurs and making music in the home, singing in church, all that sort of thing. I'm not advocating religion, but I'm saying an enormous amount of music came from church.
Richard Gill, you are an unusual specimen, though. You were an obsessive piano player as a kid. Take us, though, to when your first year of music teaching at Marston High School. This was a suburban high school. You managed to pull off an opera, probably more than one.
We did. I wrote two operas for the kids there, one based on the Pied Piper and another based on two Aboriginal legends. And this was one of the first co-ed schools. It was an experiment, I guess, in education in the 1950s when the Wynnum Report started, and co-educational schools started to spring up all over Sydney. And we were in a group of seven. And these were fantastic kids. I had an extraordinary time at this school, and I was there for 7 years.
It taught you a lot about what not to do with music education, didn't it? There were some real wake-up calls. I think you were trying to engage a group of Year 9 students with Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in C minor.
Yes.
and you got an interesting response that's kind of defined your thinking ever since.
Well, it has. It's a story I tell often, and having played this music to these children, I asked them this most stupid question you could possibly ask, like, what did you think of that? And this boy said, well, it's the same old crap over and over again. Na 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 na. And the kids agreed.
And that was, en masse, they agreed.
Absolutely, they agreed. And that was like a fantastic wake-up call for me. And it's a story I tell often because I had assumed the idea that as a crusader, these kids all should like Beethoven and that it was better than anything else they might like. The arrogance of that, when you look back at it, is spectacular. But I got the lesson, and thank God that the kid said it.
Well, what lesson did you get?
The lesson?
Because if you walk into music classrooms around Australia now, I bet you that still happens.
I'm sure... Well,
I'm not dissing music teachers, by the way.
No, there are many passionate,
creative music teachers in Australia.
There are spectacular music teachers in Australia.
You know, curriculum can get in the way of a creative learning experience.
It sure
ironically.
Can. Oh, it sure can. Particularly if the curriculum is devoted to standardised testing and that bladder could get in the way of creative experiences.
Yes, we might come back to that.
But what I learned from that was you do not turn people onto anything by telling them that it's good. They have to experience it in a way that they find out for themselves. And if that had been mentioned to me while I was training as a teacher, I didn't remember it. But I sure as hell remember that kid giving that comment.
So how would you do that now with Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in C minor?
Right. Well, I'd still give it to children and I'd play a little bit at the opening and I'd just say, all right, what did you hear? What did you observe about the sounds you just heard?
Blank stare. Initially,
exactly.
I imagine.
Listen again. Tell me something about the sound. And I do the same when I'm working with children with an orchestra. I'll play something and I'll say to the kids, what did you hear? And they'll say, music. So that's always a good start, right?
That's a good start. We're on the same page.
We've recognised the music. Now, what instruments did you hear playing that? Tell me something about the level of the sound and so on. So we start to build information from what they are hearing. And that's old-fashioned analysis and observation. Mm. And it happens with a teacher in front of a group of children, interacting with the children and repeating the music, playing the music over and over so they can build on what they know, build on their observation. And while they're doing that, the listening level is high. The concentration is high. And you can do that with very young children. You know, that doesn't have to be, there is nothing that says Beethoven 5 is singularly appropriate for year 9. It's appropriate right across the board. And it's at the level at which you work with the children that counts.
What did the 20th century German composer Karl Orff teach you? Because he was a great musical editor. People will know him because of Carmina Burana.
Yeah.
But you spent time in Salzburg.
I did. I studied in Salzburg, and Orff came down and visited us with Gunnel Kateman, his co-worker.
He was a great music educator. People might not know that about him.
Yeah. In fact, all teachers who teach music know about Karl Orff almost exclusively as an educator, but also an opera composer. And he wrote for theatre. And I love that combination, that he wrote for theatre and he wrote music for children. And his view was he would never explain Orff-Schulwerk to us. He would say, my work is like a garden. It grows. Things change in the garden. Some things don't work. And you take them out of the garden and let other plants grow. And people would look at him and say, you know, stop talking in riddles. And what I got from it was children make their own music. So what you do is you put things in their way that they reorganize in their own way.
Mm.
And that's why the instruments are there. They can play on xylophones and tambourines and drums and sing. And it's not just instrumental. It's very it's vocally based as well.
Acclaimed music educator, music director, conductor Richard Gill is my guest this morning on Life Matters. His new memoir is called Give Me Excess of It. You've made, in leading many of the institutions that you have, you've made some fierce enemies along the way too. You've had some great love affairs, I guess, with music and the people who love it. But you've made some enemies. And what I do love about this book is that you acknowledge your failures as well, you know. It's not a hagiography of your life.
No, no. Oh, wow.
You know, I mean, you do acknowledge your failures and limitations.
Yeah.
And I think that's very powerful for people to read.
Oh, thank you. I think, you know, the Delphi Oracle, know thyself. And Hamlet, that hit me actually at school when... Although we didn't study Hamlet when I was at school, we studied the Scottish play, Midsummer Night's Dream, A Merchant of Venice, Twelfth Night, there were, you know, all of those, Caesar. But I knew the speech, Polonius's advice to Laertes. And when it closes, to thine own self be true, and then it follows this day, the night that canst not be false to any man, or close to that.
Mm.
And the Delphic Oracle, know thyself. And I think... they're really important things, and they're lessons that are really hard to take on board because you like to think you're immortal and you have the corner on truth and you know everything. And I certainly went through that stage. There's no question. I was immortal. I knew everything and had the corner on truth.
Well, I think you're still immortal. You reckon you've got another 50 years to go?
I hope so.
As you head to the gym every day.
But it is terribly important to acknowledge your limitations. And if you don't, you don't know how to fix them.
But with leadership comes courage too, and the courage of your convictions.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've always had that, although you do acknowledge that you're a kind of square peg that never found a hole for yourself.
Yeah. And that's okay too. That doesn't worry me. And I know I've offended people along the way. I mean, I've had my fights, let me tell you. And sometimes I've been wrong. I've been wrong in those fights, although the principle behind it was probably right. I wasn't experienced enough to handle it the right way. Because often you feel very strongly about something and you just go for it. And I think a lot of that comes from a bit of OCD. And people say
I think it's a bit of OIC as well. IOC as well, which
is interfering old cow. That's a term I use in the rehearsal room as an interfering old cow when I'm working with a director.
How do you use it?
Well, I often watch opera directors work, and I'll watch them take a singer through something, and I think, well, actually, the music is not doing that. I think I'm just going to say something. So I just say, look, I know I'm an interfering old cow, but when she comes down there, why can't she just wait for the pause and then turn, for example? So... and then I've made my point. But I qualify by saying I am being an interfering old cow, but that's okay.
You'd like to be an interviewing old cow about NAPLAN.
Oh, absolutely.
And the future of arts education in Australia.
Yeah, you bet I would.
What's the bee in the bonnet there?
I have a real... First, you have to test children. There's no question about that. But a good teacher is testing all the time. So, for example, in a primary classroom, teachers who are teaching reading and writing, they're teaching and testing almost simultaneously. They're assessing how every child is going all the time.
Now, a good teacher.
Good teacher. What standardised testing does is allow teachers to teach exclusively to the test. And you can go into shops now where you can buy tests for children to practice.
Does it make you weep?
Well, it does, because I can't see what standardised testing achieves. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of teachers to whom I speak who say standardised testing is a blight and a blot on our teaching landscape.
Doesn't it give us a sense, though, of how children are faring?
No. It's artificial. The test happens on one day. It doesn't tell the teacher anything about the child he or she doesn't already know. It doesn't necessarily tell the teacher anything about the direction needed to be taken. And lots of schools will say, we haven't had an extra penny as a result of our testing. There was a fantastic article in The Age in Melbourne recently from a primary school teacher who spoke out. And it was great to hear this teacher say this. And teachers and parents need to speak out about it.
Even if they do speak out, NAPLAN has landed. A national curriculum is landing. So how should teachers respond to that in the classroom?
Well,
because you've been very effective at subverting the dominant paradigm, working within systems, pushing at the edges. Do you have any thoughts about how teachers navigate the landscape ahead so as best to enrich the lives of their students?
I do. The draft curriculum in music was sent out all over Australia, and the response from the music teachers was fantastic. The music teachers came back and said, we won't work with this curriculum. And what was good about it was ACARA sent the draft, and ACARA is taking the responses very, very seriously. So there will obviously be rewrites of the draft curriculum. Now, that's a really good circumstance. The thing I really get concerned about is that in education, we're in danger of becoming overly democratic, so that everybody has a say. And that's incredibly...
Death by committee.
Exactly. It's incredibly dangerous. It's like brain surgery for fun and profit. And you think, what is this about? You know, there are teachers. We have to trust our teachers. And not only do we have to trust them, but in Australia we have to start empowering them by recognising what they do and rewarding them at a greater rate, and certainly paying them more money and selecting stronger and brighter people. And the example I always come to is Finland, where law, medicine and teaching are in the same category at university entrance. Now, they take 18 years to get to the top of the pay scale in Finland. They start school and they're seven. I mean, it's a fantastic system.
Could we do it here?
We could. I was speaking about this the other night and someone said, Finland is not like Australia, it's not like a big multicultural country. Fine, that's true. But let's look at all the best bits of Finnish or Norwegian and Swedish education and say, we can take some of those and apply them to our system here.
Gee, there's so much we could talk about. That's the nature of a memoir called Give Me Excess of It.
Correct.
Can't wait to see what the next 50 years has for you.
Thank you, Natasha.
as you suggest in the book. great to have you on the show, Richard, as ever, and good luck with spreading the message.
Natasha, thanks for the opportunity.
Richard Gill, and yes, his memoir is indeed Give Me Excess of It, published by Pan Macmillan, music director of the Victorian Opera and also currently overseeing the Sydney Symphony Education Program, amongst many other roles. On Life Matters, another passionate and determined Australian coming up this way in just a moment.